Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is Celtic Underground number 259. Those of us of a certain age were very lucky when it came to watching football on the television. Yes, people under the age of 25 have known nothing other than live football on the TV whenever they want it, whichever game they want. And that can be great, but there was something special about going to the game on a Saturday and coming home and watching the highlights on a Saturday night, and those highlights being hosted and commentated on by a man with unbounded enthusiasm for our game, Mr. Arch McPherson. I'm not going to bore you too much with an intro because Arch McPherson's far more articulate than I will ever be. So enough from me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight from me. I'll speak to you the other end, because what we've got coming up is the wonderful, loquacious, fantastic Mr. Arch McPherson in conversation with our own St. Anthony.
Good evening. Sometimes it really does happen. Today was one of those occasions when, around about 4 o'clock, we knew we were going to have a combination of football matches that will be hard to beat all season. It then got even better. So we not only have a barrel load of goals for you, but football that comes right out of the top draw.
It's my great privilege today to be joined by a man who needs no introduction. Anyone who knows anything about Scottish football will be very aware of the dulcet tones of one Archie McPherson. So we'll bash right on into the interview with Archie, and we'll, just as always, Archie's a wee icebreaker. We always ask, what's the first football match that you recall going to, and who was your first football hero?
I was brought up in the east end of Glasgow in Shettleston, and my father had played for Shettleston Juniors, so I was taken along, not to see him playing, he was beyond it by that stage. I lived in 771 Shettleston Road, and I remember being taken up by an uncle, and there were no turnstiles at Shettleston Juniors, but if you bent low enough, you got in without anybody actually seeing you, which is what I did. So my first recollection is of watching Shettleston Juniors, and I have a firm recollection of one of the most famous men in Scottish football making his debut at Greenfield Park, Shettleston, and who lived not very far away from where I was born in the Bowery. He only played about six games for Shettleston before he was signed by Celtic, and I'm talking about Tommy Docherty. So I watched the Doc make his debut in Greenfield Park, and I can always remember, not with any great deliberation, I just a visual image of him in this shirt, standing out a mile, just being a different kind of player. And then he disappeared and went to Celtic. He didn't last long with Shettleston Juniors. And that was it. So my first recollection was there. I wouldn't say he was my first hero, because I followed a man who was absolutely brilliant, who never made a name in Scottish football, called Doc McManus. He was an inside forward for Shettleston Juniors. His belly preceded him. You felt as if he trained down at the local pub. His belly went one way and his hips went the other, which made him a very deceptive inside forward. He was a traditional Scottish inside forward, which we used to breed over and over again, not so much now. And so he was the first one. He had long, straggly hair, curly hair, and just magnificent on the ball. He had no pace, he had no energy, and so on. You might have called him a pub player in those days, but he was brilliant. Manipulated the ball very well. So these were my early recollections, and my association with Shettleston goes right through to last year when I went down with the local MP and was introduced to the Shettleston players. I can't remember the particular occasion. It may have been during the general election, I'm not sure, but in any case, I went down there and met the players. Always wanted to play for the town eventually. So that's my early recollection. Mm-hmm. The first team I watched.
Now, career-wise, that you were a teacher to begin with, and indeed you became a headmaster.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to how you went from being a headmaster to being a TV presenter. How did that come about?
Well, it's a complicated story because when I was a teacher, you weren't very well paid, and I thought I'd better start doing something with my life and be creative as if I possibly could. So I started to write short stories for different publications. And as James Thurber once said, the rejection slips came back like ping pong balls from the other side of the net. I was rejected over and over again. But one day, I was in my then fiance's house, and now my wife, in Glenboy. And I happened to pick up the early edition of the Evening Times. I was teaching in Glenboy at that time in the school. And I saw my story in the Evening Times. Now, in those days, I didn't want many people to know I was moonlighting, if you like, by writing stories and so on. It's a stupid thing when I think back on it. So I took a pen name, Alan Marshall, just my own initials, AM.
Mm.
And that kicked me off. That you know, I've been at umpteen Olympic Games, World Cups, European finals and everything, but nothing equals seeing your first work in public. It's like seeing your first child in the cradle, seeing something you worked on and tried to shape and be stylish with actually being read by the public. You know, that was just amazing. So I continued to write until the BBC accepted a story from me, a short story from me, by the producer, the talks and drama producer, a man called Jimmy Crampsey, who was Bob Crampsey's uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked my story, and he broadcast it. And I didn't particularly like the way it was read, so I had the audacity to ask him for my next one if I could read it myself. So he said, okay, we'll come in and give you an edition. So he said, yeah, that's okay, fine. And I went down for a cup of tea into the BBC canteen and bumped into some people there who were with the sports department and knew I'd played a little bit of football, amateur football. I was with Queen's Park at one stage, Queen's Park, Hampden 11. And they said, would you be interested, we've listened to your voice there, would you be interested in doing some sports reporting for us? So I was actually writing a short story which had nothing to do with sport, that gave me my first step into the BBC.
Fate's a funny thing, isn't it?
It is indeed. So they gave me a game to do. The first ever game I did was only about 10 minutes away from where we were sitting at Hamilton Accies ground, Douglas Park. And it was at the time of the Cuban crisis. And I always remember going trundling in the bus. It was a Saturday of the Cuban crisis, which was the worst day of all, with the steam, the Soviet ships steaming for Cuba, and God only knows what was going to happen. So what had I to soothe me and calm me? Hamilton Accies against Dennis Muir for 90 minutes. And I got through that, went back. And I did a report into the Eamon Andrews program. Eamon Andrews, a name from way back.
This Is Your Life.
This Is Your Life, man. But he did sport before he did This Is Your Life. And that was me started as I started to work in radio. And then eventually they gave me a stint on television doing reports. And then asked me to do a commentary. The first ever commentary was, and this will date it.
Mm-hmm.
It was Third Lanark against Hibs.
Well, it must have been pre-67.
Yeah, because they went out of existence in 67, the very week that Celtic won the European trophy, in fact. The last game they played was against Dumbarton. So we're talking about 63, around about 63. So you can date it with the Cuban crisis.
Yeah.
Maybe I did the commentary about a year later. And that was me away. That was me started.
Mm-hmm. Now, at that time in the BBC, and you've documented this in your book, Jock Stein felt that there was perhaps a wee bit of bias in the BBC, anti-Celtic bias.
Yeah.
Is that something is factually correct. Or
oh, yeah. That was just, we've written about this very clearly. There were one or two people within the BBC who didn't like Celtic. And it was subtle, but it was there. And he realised that because Jock was the man who got in everywhere, who listened to everybody. And there are a lot of people, because of his reputation, he was a tough man, would tell him things about what was happening. So he realised that. And so there was a great deal of animosity until I myself, realising this was just preposterous, went out to see him at Celtic Park. Stood in the boardroom with him, like bearding the lion, if you like to put it that way, and said, yeah, I agree with you, this must stop. And he said, and I said it in a practical way, not just, and by the way, I wasn't in charge of the BBC at that time. I was under an editor, but I was getting a bit stronger in my position there. So I was taking decisions. So I said to him, I want you to come up, if you accept what I mean, I want you to come up and do a game for us, an international game, as an analyst. Mm-hmm. And he pondered for a minute and then said, yeah, I'll come. So up he came, and that was the breaking of the ice.
And yeah, I recall in later years, that in the Wembley years, when the England-Scotland fixture, especially at Wembley, was a huge fixture. You commentating, and after the game, Jock being in the studio with you.
Yes.
So obviously through the years,
oh, through the years,
a working, if yep. not a friendship.
Yes, we eventually travelled the world together, and towards the middle of his career, he had changed completely because of me, because of my relationship with him. And it went on so that I did many famous games with him. I did the famous, I suppose you'd call it the Scottish variation of The Hand of God at Anfield with Joe Jordan.
Yeah.
So they say.
Do you know, it's a funny thing, I've got a real list of questions here that just to keep myself right. And my recollection of you as a commentator, there's a couple of games I'm going to touch on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really funny you mentioned that. That is one of the games that I always remember your commentary, particularly the second goal.
Well, I went over the top. That was my Pavarotti
those
moment.
Were, those were great times, though, in Scottish football. Yeah. Exciting times.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could call it the golden age of Scottish football. We didn't go on to win things, which Ernie Walker, the former SFA secretary, used to remind me. But in terms of involvement, drama, spectacle, passion, dating from Lisbon to Barcelona to Gothenburg, and all the internationals that took place at that time, we always had a chance of winning. You always felt you had a chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's becoming more difficult.
Very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate to speak to Roger Bailey a wee while back, and I think you and him, you must have crossed careers because you're of the same age group. And Roger says that he regards himself as very fortunate because these were halcyon days, 60s, 70s, 80s, European finals, great runs in European football, and then Scotland qualifying almost every 4 years for the World Cup.
Well, we got to the stage where you began to assume that a Scottish team would every 3 or 4 years win a European trophy or at least get to a final and progress. And I think that was maintained up until about the mid-80s. And then you began to wonder just if this is going to materialise the way we thought it would. And, of course, it wasn't. I mean, the very fact that a small nation like ourselves qualified for 5 World Cups in a row, and I was at all these World Cups, I was blessed in that regard. You know, when I think back in what it's like now, where it's debatable if we'll ever get to a World Cup.
Yeah.
I certainly hope we will, but it's highly debatable. But in those days, we just did it all the time.
But there were some great nights getting there. You know, the qualifying games were fantastic.
Yeah, I mean...
Your Czechoslovakias and your Spain and your France, etc.
Yeah, my good mate, Arthur Monford, that was his famous remark, watch your legs, Billy, when Billy Bremner, as if he was a punter in the terracing, rather taken away by it all. And yes, some of the pre-qualifying games, like the one in Anfield, for example, where I did my Pavarotti moment, I hit top C when a goal was scored, were perhaps even more exciting than the finals themselves, because Argentina, of course, was a huge disappointment, terrible disappointment. And I look back on all these other qualifying games that we had, and yes, you're right. I could put the case that this was the greatest era from the 60s right up to the 90s, 30 years of wonderful entertainment, passion, and qualified success. Yeah. Let's just put it that way. And I'm lucky to have lived through it.
Your comments there, the Lisbon final when Celtic beat Inter Milan is often shown on the TV. You hear it all the time. And that there's a story that I've heard that might have been yourself that told it, although I'm not sure, that Kenneth Wollstoneholm was there doing it for the BBC in England. And apparently he was a nice man. He was a good commentator. Mm-hmm. He's always remembered for his England-Germany World Cup final. I think it's all over, it is now. And apparently after the game, he came running down the steps to Jock Stein shouting, Jock, we've done it. As if he was one of us, you know.
Exactly. He was a nice enough man. But he latched on to Celtic towards the end. I'm sure, I can't obviously prove that. I'm sure, like many other Englishmen, he didn't really believe that Celtic would win that final.
Did you, in all honesty, looking back now, did you think Celtic could win that final? Is the rounds
went I think Inter Milan were favourites.
No, I'm talking about when they got to the quarters and then the semis and then the final.
Well, it was always possible. It was certainly always possible. And these dramatic goals that I did the commentary on, Billy McNeil's header against Vojvodina, for example, from Charlie Gallagher's corner kick. Against like that, when Jock Stein turned to Sean Fallon beside him when it was still a draw with seconds to go, minutes to go or so on, and say, oh, we're going to have this bloody extra game in Rotterdam. I think it was Rotterdam.
A third place playoff in those days.
A one-off game. And then the goal came. So you went thinking, well, there's a chance here, but there's no doubt. You can't disguise it. Inter Milan were a famous club, an established club, with an established form of football, the Catenaccio style, you know, which wasn't attractive to watch but was very effective. So there's no doubt that they were favourites, yes.
And what about afterwards? What's your memories of after the match? It must have been a really emotional time.
It was. Curiously enough, the thousands were milling on the pitch by this stage, and I was asked to go down and try and get an interview with Jock Stein. There was absolutely no chance, because Jock was actually on the pitch at that time, trying to, against the odds, throw people off, because he wanted the cup to be presented. Yeah. You see, they weren't presenting the cup.
Only Billy and Sean went up.
But even at that stage, they weren't going to present the cup until they tried to clear the pitch. So I got nowhere near him. I remember Tommy Gemmell's been pulled asunder, one arm and another arm, and they were trying to pull him away. It was just the excitement of the occasion. So I went back to my position. I told the BBC in London that there was no chance of me getting down there, because that time Jock had disappeared in the crowd and the throng. So this Portuguese guy came along to me, and he says, I wonder, Mr. McPherson, if you would mind going to the public address system, and could you ask the Celtic supporters if they could please leave the pitch? And I said to him, what is the Portuguese for get stuffed? There was absolutely no way that they would listen to me or anybody. They were on the pitch and staying there. And eventually Billy came round with the cup, right in front of us. Right in front of us. His back turned towards us, obviously facing the pitch. And that's where the presentation took place.
Of all the European finals, there's never been one, I don't think, that had that surrounding. It was almost like Romanesque. The big pillars.
It was.
And the height that Billy was up and the cameras facing up the way, almost as if it was like some footballing god.
Because it wasn't a football stadium.
No.
It wasn't built as a football stadium. It was
sports stadium.
Built as a political stadium.
Oh.
This is where Salazar had these political rallies. That's why it was three-sided.
So that was a Portuguese dictator?
Salazar. Exactly. Dr. Salazar was the dictator. There was a dictatorship at that time. And it was three-sided because they wanted the speakers to be on that side and so on. You know, it was like a Nuremberg sort of atmosphere to it. But they converted it into that. I have to tell you, I couldn't quite answer the question as to why they put it there rather than the Stadium of Light, Benfica Stadium, which actually was bigger.
And held a lot more.
And held a lot more. I'm not quite sure. Maybe they wanted to put on a show of some kind. I don't know. But in any case, that's where they played.
So through the years, everyone came to know you for what was originally Sports Rail before it became Sports Scene.
That's right.
And Arthur was on the Sunday afternoons with Scott Sport. Was there ever a friendly rivalry? Was there ever a wee bit of competition between you both? Or were you happy that each of you had your own niche?
Well, it was a rivalry, of course, but not a bitter rivalry. There was a friendship and a bond. And I'll tell you why there was a bond. We were hated by the written media. The written media didn't want television. Television was in its... Sports television in Scotland was in its infancy at that time. Black and white film looked like Max Sennett films at times. And they were worried about what inroads they would make into their credibility. So you got to the stage where if you were criticising the newspaper or Arthur was criticising the newspaper... You felt they were gunning for us. Mm. I remember standing at Broomfield, the old Broomfield once, Airdrie were playing Sunday, I can't remember. Oh, I'll tell you who it was. They were playing Partick Thistle, and it might have been a cup game, I'm not sure. Anyway, no, they were playing Clydebank, because Jack Steedman, who was chairman of Clydebank at the time, and I walked onto it, always walked onto the pitch to have a look at the pitch, so I say I was on the pitch, etc. And he came striding across to me and he said, you know, if I had my way, I would throw you and your cameras out of this ground. I said, how do you mean? He said, no, you're ruining Scottish football. You're going to have people watching it on the telly and not actually going through the turnstile. So, no. And he was quite open about it, pleasantly. I mean, he wasn't obnoxious. He just said, no, you're the enemy of football. Well, he had a compatriot by the name of Sir Bob Kelly. Mm-hmm. Because Sir Bob Kelly was always suspicious of television. Mm-hmm. He had gone to the States in his earlier days, after the war and so on, that period between, say, 1945 and the mid-60s. And he had watched the effect that television had on baseball, where the crowds had dwindled dramatically. So he was absolutely against television coming in and taking over live games, etc., etc. And that was something we had always watched. However, it changed because by that time, you'll correct me, I think Sir Robert had died, I'm not quite sure.
Desmond White
took over. Well, Italian television came along, this was a very, very famous game, and said to Celtic, we want you to change your kickoff time. And he did it for the first time. It was 8 o'clock, and that famous game was the game against Milan at Celtic Park.
And Dixie missed the penalty.
Missed the very first penalty, the very first ever penalty taken in a European shootout. And why? Why did he change it for television and the money that came in? I mean, it's understandable. Mm-hmm. The age had changed. Television was the main source, as it now is, the main source, as you now see from Sky and everything else, was the main source of an income. You couldn't rely on spectators coming through the turnstiles. It had to be the big bucks, and with it, on the back of it, sponsorship, which would bring and so on. So we had that 8 o'clock kickoff, and it couldn't be live at that stage, because SDV were doing the Rangers game, which kicked off at the traditional time, 7:30. We were going to be doing recorded high at BBC, but we were going to do live at the same time, and so I'm competing with one another. Whereas Celtic were just going to get recorded highlights. But of course, it worked to my advantage. I was at Celtic Park doing that commentary because the game went to extra time. Mm. And that whole of extra time was taken out live. So we got the
bonus at the end.
The last bit of the game and then full time and a penalty shootout, which was very dramatic. So the view changed and it's never been anything other than that, television has dictated the terms, and it still does more dramatically now than it ever has.
I mean, you're correct here in what you say, that Celtic, were, as a club, were always vociferously against television, especially with Kelly and White. But there was one instance that I was speaking to Joe Craig recently, who was a Celtic centre forward in the 70s, and he scored the winning goal one day at Easter Road on the day that Tom Hart refused to let the cameras in.
Yeah.
Now, this was the 33rd game of a 36th season.
Yeah, I remember.
And it seemed very strange for Tom Hart at that point to take a stand against television, when in the previous 32 games, he's been perfectly okay with it. So.
Yeah, well, I knew Tom Hart only too well. It was very interesting to know. I had an interview with him once where he was very open and said for the new league that was about to be started, the new Premier League and so on, we don't want Dundee United. That's the one club we don't want. And the reason, he said, well, they don't have a support. You know, what would they get? 5,000? Something like that. He didn't like the regime as well. Mm-hmm. And he was quite adamant about that. But in fact, Dundee United got in merit. I merely reflect that to tell you what kind of man he was. Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted to dictate, obviously, you know. So he was unfair in that respect, yeah.
Well, one of the things I always wondered for my own curiosity was, how did you come at the weekend to choose the game that you wanted to show, and was there any consultation with ScotSport to make sure that you didn't show the same game?
No, never. At that stage, in these earlier stages, no. It was just first come, first served. You just got in and you did. It didn't matter if they were there or whatever, especially with cup finals. I have to say that when we did the cup finals in competition, we always won 3-1.
They got adverts, though. I mean, personally speaking, I would always watch the BBC simply because I don't want to watch the adverts.
No, exactly. That was a big advantage for us. So, no, there was no cooperation about that at all. There were times when they would decide to do a European game and we wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was just a simple, straightforward choice, you know.
So in the days, going on to more of a Celtic connection, the old TV gantry used to perilously hang above the old jungle.
The jungle, yes.
The jungle had a certain reputation in those days for the denizens who occupied it, the songs that come out of the bottles that used to fly out, etc. But you must have special memories at that place.
Well, I also had pleasant memories of it. I got a shuriken from time to time, that's for sure. Expressing their democratic opinion, but no, there was nothing. It was usually good humoured. There was no real, I felt anyway. Maybe I was getting myself on, but I don't think so. No, I think it was fairly good humoured in those days, and it was suffocatingly hot. Doesn't matter what kind of day it was, because the heat coming from the bodies from below you. Was fantastic. I remember John Gregg got a job for the BBC doing reports, and when he was given the job to do Celtic Park, and he had to go into the jungle and up the sun, he said, the game was on the Saturday, I went on the Tuesday and hid in the gantry so they wouldn't see me.
So how did you get to the jungle then? Was it a ladder or something?
You walked around the ground from... You went and got the teams, you walked around the perimeter of the ground, around the track. You went to the back, the very back of the jungle, and there was a ladder up there, and then you walked over this bridge and got onto the it was a great viewing place for television.
It was. The Celtic games were always very clear, you know.
So. Better, in my opinion, better and more intimate, because the one at Celtic Park is very high. Mm-hmm. It gives you a great panoramic view of the pitch, but when you were in the jungle, you felt you were on the touchline.
Mm-hmm. It almost overhung the park.
It did, yeah.
Rather than on it. So, again, talking about the TV, just to say, it was very strange. You were always used to doing it on Saturday night, and you come into our living rooms every Saturday night, and it's very strange talking to you, because I almost feel as if I know you, because your face was so commonplace within the household. Mm-hmm. And for one season only, I think ScotSport got the contract for the Saturday, and you went to the Sunday, just for one season. It was in 1980. And could have been. Jock Brown took over in STV.
Could have been. Yeah, that's
for
right.
Arthur. And it just didn't seem right. You know, it's funny, after all those years you've been on Saturday night, to see you on a Sunday afternoon, it was weird.
No. Really weird. You know, you're bringing, I can barely remember that now.
It was only one season.
Yeah, I can barely remember.
And then it reverted back. It was almost as if people said, this is not the way it should be.
Yeah.
BBC's got to be the Saturday night, STV's got to be the Saturday afternoon, and it reverted back.
Yeah, I think it's because people were conditioned to that more than anything else. And you're dead right in saying that. Yeah.
So in 1977, the Scottish Cup final was live for the first time in the modern era.
Mm-hmm.
And as a commentator, would you have been nervous doing a live match opposed to doing the normal game where you could have edited it afterwards and before it goes out?
No, we had done live games, and I didn't do them very well. I'll tell you one game in particular, and that was the British Championship. For the first time, the British Championship was contracted into a week, where you played Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, mm-hmm. and got all the games over. And the first game was at Wrexham, between Scotland and Wales, obviously. And when we got to my commentary position, we discovered that the BBC in London had erected scaffolding right in front of our commentary position. So I did the commentary live through this mesh that was put in front of us. Mm-hmm. They didn't realise that Scotland were going to do a commentary as well, because they were sitting up in this gantry with a glorious view, and we didn't. And then the following, the worst I can remember in commentating, we went to Hampden, it was Scotland, Northern Ireland, and it was pissing down all day. Mm-hmm. It was just rattling down all days. And then in these positions, in those days at Hampden Park, you were very low. You were down where the dugouts are. Mm. There was no high platform or anything else. And the floodlights were terrible in those days. You know, they really were. Okay, technically they were floodlights, but you had to do a lot of guesswork. And with the mud, within 10 minutes, every jersey was spattered with mud, and I couldn't tell the numbers. You know, you need numbers, especially for the Irish.
Yeah.
You needed to have a crib sheet where you have the numbers in front of you. And if you look up quite the number 8, that must be George Best 7, you know, or whatever, and so on. Couldn't tell. For the whole commentary, I just had to guess and hope. And I think it was a Sunday Mail. And even the camera work there, you know, and so they had a go at me. There was one famous game down in that dungeon, I called it, just behind the dugout. 6-4 Scottish League Cup semi-final between Rangers and Kilmarnock. 10 goals. If you watched our programme at night, it was a 1-1 draw because we missed 8 of the goals. You might think that's impossible. With 16mm cameras, everything could go wrong. And the Sunday Mail described it as filming a match with a brownie while dancing on a trampoline. It was that bad. So we had the problems, but the worst one, the lowest point for me commentating was that Scotland Northern Ireland game. There was only 18,000 at the ground. With them, you could check it up yourself. It was below 20,000. Yeah, it was just such an awful night.
So in terms of the live commentary, it must have been quite sort of an experience when you went abroad and you were relaying stuff back home and you know, it's one thing doing it in your own, in Glasgow or Hamden or even in Britain, but when you actually go abroad and you're maybe relying on foreign cameras and that kind of thing.
It was always tricky. Not so much that all the cameramen that worked on these games abroad were usually quite good. Communications could sometimes be ropey. I mean, when Celtic played against Fiorentina in Florence, our communication broke down completely. Celtic had won the first game, and all they needed was a draw to go through, which they accomplished. But I had no idea whether my commentary went through or not, because our communication with Glasgow just was killed stone dead. And that's a bit uncomfortable when you're chattering away and you're not sure whether it's going through or not. And in Portugal, on one famous occasion, in the Benfica Stadium, this time Scotland playing Portugal, remember Davy Neary was playing his his first game for Scotland in that game. And remember the Alves who played with the gloves for Portugal. He's a very stylish, artistic player. Well, half an hour before kickoff, I'm sitting in the commentary position getting ready for it to go. And I saw this guy unscrewing the camera to my right-hand side, and another guy came up and unscrewed the camera. So I turned around to my Portuguese comment. He went like that. He went away, down back, and he said, there's been a dispute between the Portuguese FA and Benfica. Now, I don't know who was at fault, but somebody wasn't paying the money, and they just lifted the cameras and went. So we never got that game.
No?
No. It just died.
So in those days, you would have used that country's cameras. You wouldn't have took your own stuff, would you?
Oh, no, because that would be
too cumbersome.
No. You never took your own cameras. No. Well, in later stages, when they became more sophisticated, you could take your camera and add to it. Mm. I had gone with it from the BBC by that time.
Now, we'll move on to your commentaries. There's a few games I want to touch upon it's only a personal memory. The first one is incredible. It was a 1985 Scottish Cup final against Dundee United.
Yes.
And for 70 minutes, Dundee United were in control. Celtic were having a miserable day.
Remember it well.
They were absolutely mediocre. Mm-hmm. And as a boy standing there, I'm thinking, I can't see where you're going to get a goal.
Sure.
And then we get a free kick at the edge of the penalty.
David Proven.
And I might not repeat it word for word, but anybody who's listening to this knows what I mean. Proven and McLeod are standing over the free kick and somebody's getting treatment. And you said, only once in the history of the Scottish Cup final has a goal been scored directly from a free kick. Mm-hmm. Is this a piece of history? Mm-hmm. And with perfect timing, Davy Proven just floated it right in the top corner. And you said, this is history or that is history. And the explosion and noise at that time actually sounded as if there was fans in a gantry with you.
Sure.
Now, I was at the game, but this is the power of video in those days because we were beginning to tape the games when they were on live. And we could go home and watch them in my living room afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
And enjoy your commentary, mm-hmm. enjoy all the surroundings about things that you missed at the
Well, actually, I admitted Davy Proven made me famous that day. I said, you stepped up and did what I hoped you would do.
This is impressive because it's live TV. This is not edited.
No.
This is actually you reporting live.
Frank McGarvey scored after that with a header that I don't think he knew.
No.
He put his head in the path of the ball.
He connected.
And it went in,
That was a wonderful piece of commentary. Mm-hmm. And another one I would say is, we've already spoken about a personal memory is a primary schoolboy that night at Anfield where...
Oh, yeah.
Wales moved the game to get a bigger crowd.
Yeah.
And for some unknown reason, there was 55,000 there that night, and it's estimated that there was 35,000-40,000 in Scotland.
Yeah.
How they get tickets is absolutely
sure.
extraordinary.
Sure.
And the whole thing at the time with Ali McLeod, because he did carries along on a journey, and although the journey came to an abrupt end at the other end, it was an enjoyable process at this stage. And it was just such a... Again, as a boy watching it on the TV, but this time colour TV had broke through, and it was a great experience.
That was the biggest television audience we ever had, that game, that Scotland game. And Jock Stein was with me. He was my co-commentator that night. He looked down on as you rightly said, the vast majority were Scots, and there had been some trouble in the past at Wembley, cavorting about and so on. Mm-hmm. And I always remember Jock saying to me, I hope to God they win, because he feared there might have been a bit of trouble. And of course they did. And I remember sitting in the BBC Sports Review of the Year later that year, listening to my commentary and felt slightly embarrassed by it because I think I went over the top. I was more like the supporter on the terracing at that moment. And we didn't actually play very well that night.
No. Nobody remembers that. We only remember the goals.
You remember the goals. Yeah, you're quite right. You're quite right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I did a broadcast for the BBC recently with two other individuals, Job Brown and Chick Young. And I said, and of course, there was the great goal by Joe Jordan. And of course, they both looked at me and laughed. And I said, well, at the time, it looked a perfectly clean you know, when he went up. The penalty, I beg your pardon.
The handball.
The handball thing. So, no, it still rings a bell, that one.
The third game, I would say, is, and there is a Celtic connection, although it wasn't a Celtic game. And I remember that the day that one of the most dramatic finishes to a season of all time, when Hearts only needed a point and they went to Dens Park.
Yes.
And you guys in the BBC probably thought you'd a plum game of the day.
We went to Dens Park,
because
yes,
this was one of the historic Hearts winning their first title for how many years. And I went to Love Street that day, having to say, not holding a lot of hope. And then as matters evolved, it was such a dramatic day. But what you did do that night, and I remember rushing home that night for the pub to watch in the TV, and you conveyed a sympathetic approach to Hearts, because this was, in terms of ending season finishes, it was absolutely astounding.
Sure.
And I just always remember that you reported it so well that night in a sympathetic manner towards Hearts, but also the whole surrounding of the day, it was.
See, during that call, we weren't sure what was happening. Although, Marky, it didn't matter what was happening. I think I'm right in saying that if Dundee won, then it was finished. It wouldn't have mattered that. I might be wrong about this, but
really, what happened was Hearts only needed a draw. Regardless of what happened at Love Street, Hearts needed a draw. Even if Dundee had won, Celtic still had to win.
They had
to win by, I think it was 2 or 3 goals.
Right.
I never think for a minute that Dundee would turn the.
Yeah. There was a feeling about that game, though. I had a feeling, because I heard that, I think I'm right in saying, Sandy Jarden called off in that game.
Before the match.
Was it Craig Levein? I think it was Craig Levein. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it was Craig Levein, who was central to the Hearts' defence in those days.
Was a key player, yeah.
Absolutely key player. And you had a feeling, you know, something strange might happen here,
While it was 1-0, there's still the chance that Hearts could equalise.
Oh yeah.
But I remember your commentary when Albert Kidd's second goal was lovely. He played it 1-2, he took it under control and he absolutely lashed it right into the net.
That's right.
And he turned away to where the Dundee fans were under your cameras.
Yeah.
And you know, they're celebrating. Mm-hmm. And again, it's your commentary that's in the mind.
It was a difficult one, because there were people crying on the terracings. You know, it was just a human response to these things. And you just simply had to convey the twin emotions, that there would be jubilation at Love Street and the dejection on the terracings.
And, of course, Scottish Sport are thinking they've really got an end-of-season game in some ways. If Hearts had won the league then, the next day, there wouldn't have been many people wanting to watch Scottish Sport, but, of course, they ended up with a plum. Because all the Celtic fans on the Sunday would have been...
Watched that game. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you both did well out of that weekend.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Now, there's a debate at the moment. I'll just ask this as an aside. Social media is a great thing these days, and you know, you've got websites and Twitter and things like that. And there's a big discussion at the moment about whether Ali McLeod should be inducted into the SFA's Hall of Fame. You know, it used to be you needed 50 caps, but I think they softened it a wee bit, because guys like Jim Baxter and Jimmy Johnson didn't have anywhere near 50 caps, but there's no way that they should be missed out for this Hall of Fame. And there's a wee bit of debate at the moment about Ali, and we touched upon him there to say that he took us on a journey. And for 18 months it was terrific. It was such a wonderful journey to go on. And then, as I said there, it hit the buffers in Argentina. So where would you stand on it if it was down to you? Are you sympathetic towards Ali, or do you think, given what happened, that he doesn't deserve his place?
Well, you know, never speak unkindly of people in the grave, sort of thing.
Well, we're talking factually rather than personally.
Yeah, of course. People become identified with one particular thing in their life. Historically speaking, and Argentina he has been associated with. And I'll leave you to make up your mind, because he made terrible mistakes about Argentina. Mm. I'll give you an example. The BBC sent me all the way to Peru, working for Grandstand, sent a producer and myself away to Peru.
This before the World Cup?
Before the World Cup, to case the joint, as it were, to see what Peru were actually like. Now, we're back in 78. I don't think there was YouTube then, and I don't think there was much coming and going with videos as there is now. And I arrived in Peru with a film crew to about 100 pressmen and photographers, assuming that I had come there to spy on the Peruvians. And in fact, I think it's up in the loft, a Spanish paper had written El Espion Escocese, the Scottish spy, with my photograph. I was in my black and white jersey, I don't know, that time. Because Ali never went near them. He never saw them. To my knowledge, he didn't see me. He certainly didn't go in to see that last game they played against, it doesn't matter, Chile, I think it was, they played against. And he made a mistake once in doing an interview with Tony Gubba when he referred to the positional defence relating to certain individuals to stifle Oblitas, who was a great left winger. Mm. And he was getting the name wrong with the defender because Oblitas plays on the left and his defender he was talking about was playing on the other side of the park. And he was unfortunate in this sense that the Scottish team had peaked before they got to Argentina. And he didn't eventually handle the press all that intelligently, especially after that first defeat against Peru, where Cubillas, who was a great player, scored that front foot free kick against Alan Ruff. So you have to say to yourself, in the greatest challenge that you can get, which is the World Cup, he did fail. Mm. I mean, history is a pack of tricks we play in the dead, somebody once said, but you can't deny that that was a failure. But he was a nice guy. Yeah. He was a nice guy. And I deplored the scenes in Cordoba in the Iranian game where they were spitting on him. Oh. The Scottish supporters who were standing on tables. Yeah. I did a round of hotels with them before the World Cup with a sponsor. I was the chairman and so on. They were standing on the tables and cheering them to the ice and then this bunch spitting at him and so on. And certainly didn't deserve that. Mm-hmm. Certainly didn't deserve that. So I don't know what the criteria is.
I think there's a
for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, there's a committee who look at the merits.
Yes, I know that, but I don't know what the criteria is. Mm-hmm. As a nice guy and with the intention of doing his best for Scotland, yes, he would deserve the Hall of Fame. But if you take into account, in strictly footballing terms, Argentina was a failure, and the preparation, as I've already pointed out, wasn't adequate.
On a professional level in Argentina, was that one of your biggest disappointments?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, you were built up for it. You prepared. One of the biggest disappointments was that I didn't do the first commentary. The line wasn't booked for BBC Scotland. Somebody had forgotten to book the actual line, so it was David Coleman's commentary that went into Scotland. The Montaneros, the guerrillas, were out at that time. Somebody said, you better phone your wife in case they think the Montaneros have got you. And then it went from bad to worse. The performance, the defence against Peru was terrible. Mm. Iran was the lowest. That was the lowest. I mean, they were not a team at all. They just rushed about. Scotland couldn't cope with this.
Even watched it back home at that time and you're delaying the action, you could almost feel something wasn't right.
No.
You know, like sometimes you get a vibe in a team.
Sure.
And you think something's not right here. They're trying their best.
Mm-hmm.
But you just get this feeling from a distance that you think, geez, something's not right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, it just, and then the final game was magnificent because of we picked ourselves up. He refreshed the team.
Mm.
And they went out and played well, and they almost made it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a glorious Archie Gemmell goal.
Typical Scotland.
Yeah.
There's one phrase that I think you are famous with, it isn't the one that you get associated with?
Yes.
The roof thing with Jonathan Watson, which is a wee bit of sarcasm in his part.
Sure.
But there's one thing I always remember, and the reason why I say this is, it was the power of television to our school kids. It was a game, Celtic and Hibs, mid-70s, and you said Dixie Deans is about to let fly and he scored with this goal, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember getting to school, we're playing in the school yard, just playing football, and you could hear everybody going, oh, as soon as you get the ball, you need to let fly. And we never even knew what that meant before.
It's only
because you used that phrase in TV.
Yeah.
And I think it was a phrase you're quite common in using to describe... This is the time to shoot. You need to let fly. And this phase, amongst the school kids of the period, myself included, it shows you that the power of television, that you could put that out there and then everybody copied it.
Yeah. Well, you know, these things happen spontaneously. You don't prepare them. They just happen. They just come out of your mouth.
Right. Now, you're also a renowned journalist as well as being, an author. Mm-hmm. As well as being the famous for the commentary. And one of the best books that I think that I've read, and one that you brought out, but not many people remember it because it's maybe a wee while back, was a book, it was called, was it The Old Firm?
Blue and Green.
Blue and Green. Mm-hmm. And it was some of the most memorable Old Firm games that you went into detail and gave the before, the during and the after.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a terrific book. And there's one bit in it that strikes me as, after the Second World War, where Celtic fans and Rangers fans, Catholics and Protestants, whatever, you know, had fought together against a greater evil and come out and talked and triumphed.
Mm-hmm.
There was that feeling that somehow that maybe after 1945 when football resumes, we'll all be never going to be pals. But maybe this sectarian thing will die down. And of course, the first game back, there was some sort of 130 arrests at the game, and it showed you that this... Sort of element amongst society was still going to carry on. Mm-hmm. And the way you described it was, you said it was a great pressure valve in Scottish society. Because had it not been for that, and this 90 minutes where they can all basically shout at one another and bawl and sing and do whatever they like.
Well, I take my creed on that from Jock Stein. Jock Stein used to say to me, let them sing. Let them work out their system. It's called, the psychologists call it sublimation. That is, you get rid of it in a less harmful way than, and in the Monday morning, you'll do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You'll know Rangers supporters who would shout and bawl and sing and so on. But on a Monday morning, you're working away with you then and so on. Now, I know there's an element that will say, oh, wait a minute, you get deaths and you get wife beatings and so on, etc. But I dare say you would get that. This is a defence of the Old Firm fixture in that sense. Forget the situation at the moment, that's unique. But the traditional Old Firm fixture, and Maya and I went along with Jock Stein in this respect, unless it was sheer obscenity, the traditional songs that both of them sung shouldn't worry anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Although that some people would say, oh, yes, it perpetuates itself outside. Well, yes, you can get clashes in the city and air and pubs when drink has been had. Yeah, all of these elements go into it. But I tend to think, and Stein thought as well, that it would replace itself somewhere else, in shopping malls or in one pub against another pub or whatever.
But not far from Northern Ireland, but where they had it in a much greater scale and a horrific sort of civil war scenario. I think that I certainly felt the point you were trying to make, because it was a wee pressure valve and it let it go. And you know, the we never really had it to the degree that they were getting.
No.
Which was maybe a good thing.
Yeah. I know a lot of people disagree with me and would like to see then, forget about it just now, it doesn't exist, would then like to have seen it. But I remember the game at Celtic Park when somebody fell off the roof.
The top tier. Yeah.
Rangers won the league
that
night. I remember writing a piece, I think it was for the Herald at the time, saying, play the game behind closed doors. Next season, play it behind closed doors, just to tell the fans, for God's sake, behave.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember somebody at Celtic Park, now was it the stadium director at the time, that looks after the fans, having a go at me and saying, no, you can't do that, you must let the spectators see the game, the traditional game. Well, yes, I would love them to see it as well. But sometimes you've got to have punitive methods.
Mm.
to teach people lessons.
Do you not think these days, though, I started going in the early 70s, my dad took me, and it was quite a daunting experience going to a Celtic Rangers game, because you've got this big massive terrace, people are crammed into it, people are drinking, mm-hmm. bottles and cans,
yeah.
and there's a level of drunkenness in those days that you don't get now.
No.
So I think things are more, certainly much more, for want of a better description,
civilised.
Yeah, civilised. Yeah. Now, you still get that tension within Celtic Rangers
there
games.
Is, but it's, you see, logistically speaking, it's easier to police now.
Mm-hmm.
You can identify these people.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a simple technical thing, it may sound like. Mm. But it's easier. I'm in favour of the repeal of the present...
alcohol laws.
The alcohol and also the discrimination, the football. I think the supporters are right, they're discriminated against and so on. Because they are much more civilised. I know people outside of football cannot believe that. But the general supporter understands the problems the clubs will face if they step out of line.
Yeah. And talking about this, we can't let it go without mentioning another piece of commentary you're famous for, and I'm interested to see how you get by in sort of like difficult circumstances. The riot in 1980.
Yes.
So you're giving the commentary. Danny's about to get the cup, and then a group of Celtic fans come on.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not getting the rights and wrongs of who came on, the whole clash in the middle, and you're there to describe that. It must have been, you know, it must have been very difficult.
It was better than the game. It was better. It was an own goal, I think, wasn't it?
A fluky kind of. Danny McGinn had a shot.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah. It was better in the game, which was very negative, very apprehensive about losing, which permeates Old Firm games as well, as you know. I would hate to lose this game, rather than
did you
win it.
Did you feel under threat in the commentary?
No. I was safely remote from all. But I remember I wrote about it, I think, in the book, one of my books, I can't remember now, in which the match commander was sitting in the touchline. He's standing in the touchline watching this, and there were no police there.
Mm-hmm.
They had made a tactical error. They had put all the police outside the ground because that's where the trouble traditionally always was.
Somerville Drive was a nightmare.
Absolutely. You know, where they clashed there, it was murder. So all the police were there. So when this riot's going on, we're all throwing things at each other and so on, there was no police. And in my commentary, I said, for God's sake, where are the police, etc. And the match commander was standing with his assistant, and he said, God, what are we going to do? It had just started. It hadn't been in the middle of it. They were just kind of meeting round about the centre circle. And he says, well, what are we going to do? Will it get worse? He says, will it get worse? Have a look at the stand. And he turned around to the stand, and there were the best patrons, well-off patrons, bashing hell out of each other.
In the stand?
With the camel hair coats, and they were in the stand. They're climbing over seats to get each other. And he thought, this is going from bad to worse. And so it did, obviously. And they brought in the white horses, had to come all the way around Hampden and from behind the north stand and get onto the pitch from that.
There was a reason that day, and you've touched on it, and the reason that I think I know a wee bit about this, do you remember the game? It was a Drybrough Cup final. Davy Cooper scored that great goal against Celtic.
Yes,
he did a dribble and scored.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was a scorching hot day.
Yeah.
And I remember after the game, passing by Somerville Drive there, and it was just a no-go area. They were knocking hell at each other.
Oh, yeah.
And the police were nowhere to be seen at that point.
Yeah.
So I think what actually happened, now this is only a matter of maybe like 8 or 9 months later, I think the police thought, we're going to be ready. See, when they all come out again in Somerville Drive and the surrounding areas, we will have plenty of men there, and we're never thinking for a minute that they're going to scale the fence and have it out.
No, they I feel sorry for them in that respect.
So
it was bad luck, if you're right. But they did say that had they had an element of the core there, they might have stopped this.
Mm-hmm. So, getting back to your commentaries then, with a Celtic perspective, I don't know if you're aware of this, if it's something you did on purpose, but I always recall that there was players, and I'm talking about the Celtic guys here, that there was others as well, that the guys that I think that you liked and appreciated, he had a habit of referring to them by their Christian name, almost like a term of endearment. I'll give you an example. It could be, there's Doyle, he passes it to Proven, and there's Danny on the overlap.
Aye.
Or it would be, there's Dean's passing it to Lennox. Oh, there's Kenny in the centre.
Yeah.
It was Kenny and Danny and Charlie and Paul. The guys who I think that you know, the great sort of...
It might have been, it wasn't a conscious...
It's maybe a subconscious thing. Yeah. But I always recall, I used to think, actually must like them because you're referring to them by their Christian names.
Well, I knew Charlie well. I mean, the Rangers supporters used to chant at me at Ibrox, "Archie sleeps with Charlie." You know, I wish I had, because he's well off now, you know. These things... You know, they just occurred.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They just occurred.
So, what Celtic players did you take a great pleasure in over the years?
Well, Billy, obviously. I knew him, got to know him personally, got him into the BBC to do stuff with us, which he was very good at. And Danny, of course, whose wife worked at the BBC, curiously enough.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny. The first time I saw Kenny was in Malpensa Airport in Milan after the defeat against Feyenoord, and Steen said to me, he said, he's going to be some player. I didn't know him at the time. He was carrying a hamper. He's going to be some player. So I watched his progress there on. Dixie Deans I got to know in later life. Jimmy Johnson, of course, I wrote a book about Jimmy, mostly about his illness, and spent a lot of time in the house with he and his wife, who were a comedy act, would you believe? Even at the height of his terrible, debilitating disease, you know, they cracked jokes with each other all the time. When he was able to do that, which was wonderful and inspiring. And, you know, a lot through the years, Bobby Lennox and Stevie Chalmers were brilliant with me for my Steam book.
Mm-hmm.
They were very revealing for me about that, very frank. So I got to know a good few of them. You don't do that now.
No, I've
you don't get to know
the,
them now.
I spoke to some of the modern journalists. I've been fortunate to talk to some of them, and they're very envious of guys like yourself and Roger Bailey, who basically just became, the way Roger Bailey described it to me is, he says, I became friends with the players.
Mm-hmm.
He says, and some things went on, he says, I could have got a big scoop,
mm-hmm.
but I would keep it under my hat because I didn't want to lose that friendship.
Well, it's the same. I wasn't an investigative journalist, you know. Mm-hmm. I was just a guy who worked in television, would like the odd interview from time to time. But, and again, you know, you have to be careful about friendships, too, for a commentator in particular, because you may have to criticise them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to me with Sir Alec, of course, when I didn't criticise him, I criticised his goalie, and he took strong exception to it, Jim Leighton. So, and I was very friendly with Alec, as they used to call him in those days.
Mm.
So you got to be careful about not compromising yourself with a guy who's extremely nice, you get on very well with, and then you're going to say, well, what a hell of a game you had, you know? Mm. He's very poor today or something, you know. So you have to be very careful with friendships in this business.
So I took up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. Just to close off, what does the future hold for Archie McPherson?
Well, I remember there's a guy called William Goldman. He was a famous writer. He wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the film. Great film scriptwriter. He was talking about his own career and about work and so on. And he says, you're never finished until the phone stops ringing. Now, you've rung me. Mm-hmm. Other people still ring me.
Good to know.
So by that definition, I'm not finished yet. But you never know. You know, I don't go out hunting any longer. Mm-hmm. That's finished. I did. The BBC invited me on to do a commentary for them, a commemorative commentary for that 40 years of sports.
That was an enjoyable program, looking back through the years.
And I did that for them, and they said they would give me back some other time to an opportunity to hear my voice in the airwaves again.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I worked with STV, very good, Radio Clyde, very good. I've got on extremely well with them, really extremely well. But I suppose I emotionally, I suppose I'd like to finish my career with the BBC.
Mm-hmm. Because there is that link.
Yeah,
there is.
Oh, I mean, that's how I was born and brought up. Mm-hmm.
It's a word association sports scene, ultimately.
That's right.
Scott Sport, Arthur Monthan.
No, exactly, yeah. So that's it. And
is radio more difficult than TV?
Well, yes and no. You are the game. The game can be the biggest load of crap, and yet you could, if you wanted, make it sound as if it's a World Cup final. It can be the World Cup final, and if you don't get it right, it can sound like crap. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, it's better than television. People can see what's happening, mm-hmm. and you've got to add a little bit to it. So in many respects, it was easier to do through the years, but you've got to know the players. Mm-hmm. Got to know the players very well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Not at all.
Whatever you do in the future, let me, for everybody in the Celtic Underground website, we wish you all the very best and thanks for the memories through the years.
Well, thanks for all these people that have kept me going. Thank you.
They seek him here. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. What a great man Andrew McPherson is, and a great insight and chat there with St Anthony. Don't forget all the Celtic FC Foundation stuff that you can get involved in. It doesn't have to be a formal thing. You can go and raise money in the Scottish Run or whatever on behalf of the foundation. Also, don't forget to watch the television and have a wee laugh at Rangers just now. And I uploaded a wee bit from the Celtic Underground Fergus McCann tribute podcast, the 5-minute section. It was Rangers from the period. Anyway, enough of me. That was the fantastic Archie McPherson with St Anthony, and this is me, Harry Brady, saying God bless, good night. Good night. Oh, yes, he is. He thinks he is a flower to be looked at. And when he pulls his frilly nylon pants, it's right up tight, he feels a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh, yes, he is. Oh, yes, he is. Oh, yes, he is. Oh, yes, he is. There's one thing that he loves, and that is flattery. One week he's in polka dots, the next week he's in stripes. He's a dedicated follower of fashion. They seek him here, they seek him there, in Regent Street and Leicester Square. Army marches on, each one a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is, oh yes he is, oh yes he is, oh yes he is. His world is built round discotheques and parties. His pleasure-seeking individual always looks his best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is, oh yes he is, oh yes he is, oh yes he is. He flits from shop to shop just like a butterfly. In matters of the cloth he is a thick